Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's broadcast of Alchemy of Light. How are you all doing? I am really excited to welcome our guest today, Steve Behrman, the Swami Beyond Ananda. Hello, Steve.
Well, hi, and the Swami is also available. He's floating on the proverbial magic carpet, so he is on the air, literally.
Very nice, very nice. Well, Swami, you have come to our rescue today. I must say the aura of our planet is rather stressed. We have a very sad situation happening in Japan throughout the South Pacific with the earthquake, and I must send my love and prayers to all who are affected, including friends of mine that I've not heard from. And now the nuclear reactors are exploding as if we really thought they were safe all along. And I'm thinking, wow, this is such a great day to find our funny bone. And so thank you so much for joining us in the conversation of consciousness. This is right on the mark. Right on the mark.
Well, so can I offer a story?
Please.
Okay, here's a story for everybody. A Swami, a rabbi, and a hedge fund manager are traveling in the Midwest in the U.S. They need to stop for the night. They stop at a farmhouse. The farmer says, "I'm sorry, I only have two beds. One of you is going to have to sleep in the barn." And the Swami says, "Well, I am a humble man of God," and off he goes to sleep in the barn. But 5 minutes later, there's a knock on the door. It's the Swami. He says, "Well, you know, there's a cow in the barn. Cows are sacred, but I cannot sleep near one." And the rabbi says, "Well, you know what? I have no issues with cows." Off he goes to sleep in the barn, but 5 minutes later, there's a knock on the door. It's the rabbi. He says, "There's a pig. Pigs are not kosher. You didn't tell me there's a pig in there. I can't sleep near a pig." Well, at this point, the hedge fund manager says, "You know what?" He says, "I have no issue with any animals whatsoever. We need to get some sleep." And off he goes to sleep in the barn. 5 minutes later, there's a knock on the door. It's the pig and the cow. So what's my point? My point is this, that the reason why that joke is funny is because it's not funny. And anytime we're, you know, it's not appropriate for me to make a joke about the horrible situation in Japan, about the tsunami or about the you know, potential for, you know, nuclear proliferation of fallout and blah, blah, blah. But my suggestion is that when we are able to voluntarily exhume the perspective of humor in a situation, then we can help with our own healing. We could remind ourselves that whatever the situation is, we're bigger than that situation. In the very, very cosmic sense, and I'm not saying this as a joke, and I'm saying this to perhaps reflect what many of your listeners already understand and realize, that we are eternal beings. And we've been around the block or around the planet numerous times. And from the cosmic standpoint, all of these things somehow fit into the entire picture. So that's number one. But even from the earthly perspective, when we're going through challenges and difficulties, if we're able to voluntarily choose to laugh, we can get through perhaps even the worst things. In his book, Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl talks about being in a Nazi death camp during World War II. And he made a pact with one of the other inmates that no matter what was going on, every day at some point, he and this friend would find something to laugh about. That was a vow that they made. And to give you an idea of how powerful this particular approach on humor is and how much leverage it gives you, one of the jokes that actually circulated among the inmates in the camps involved these two Jewish guys who decided that they are going to assassinate Hitler. And they know Hitler's motorcade passes this one intersection every day at 11 in the morning, and they're waiting for him. 11, 11.15, 11.30, he's not there. When he doesn't show up by 11.45, one of the assassins says to the other, Gee, I hope nothing's happened to him.
Oh, too much. I really appreciate both parts of what you just said. Yes, in fact, we are eternal beings. We are not these bodies. We're not sentenced to this 5 minutes that we're spending here on this planet. The time we've been granted in this human body is a profound gift that we actually asked for, and it's our opportunity to share the light that we bring to it. And to find humor is definitely not something we are well versed in. And for myself anyway, I actually had to learn humor. I had a lover who used to just shake her head and say, "My God, you know, what's up with all these self-help books, girl? You know, get yourself together." And she actually taught me how to laugh. And I will be forever grateful for that, because I really was missing something. And now I definitely changed. I have been transformed, and to find the pun and to find just the way that a situation can be taken less seriously, but also more, it actually broadens the perspective when you can laugh. Could you tell us how levity enlightens our perspective?
Well, first of all, a joke or comedy is really a dance between the logical, that is the linear, and the intuitive minds. You need both in order to create humor. Now, a little baby will laugh at the surprise of playing peekaboo. But in order to really appreciate humor, which is often the discrepancy between what is and what should be, you need to also have the intellect developed. So prior to the age of 6, kids are just a little bit humorally impaired. They don't exactly get what jokes are. And so when your kid first comes up with the first knock-knock joke, you know that they're on the right track. They're beginning to recognize the discrepancy between the linear logical way that things are supposed to proceed in this world and the surprise that humor gives. So in a certain sense, a joke is also a dance between the visible and the invisible. Because the invisible is always present, because everything that's happening in a joke is leading up to the punchline. 1, 2, 3. I'll give you another example. A minister, a priest, and a rabbi are talking about their legacy on the planet. How are they going to be remembered? And the discussion is, when people are standing over your casket, what do you want them to say? And the minister says, "Well, I want people to say that he was a pillar of the community and a family man." And the priest says, "I want people to say he was a leader of his flock and a holy man." And the rabbi said, "I want people to say, look, I think he's breathing."
Okay.
So let me get to my point. My point is that there's often a 1, 2, 3. There's a setup that engages the linear mind, to where the linear mind, our rational mind, believes it understands where we're going in this story. The second, the number two, number one, the minister, number two, the priest, that in a certain sense reinforces the premise established in the foundational piece. And number three, boom, that's the explosion of laughter, which is a surprise. It's the one of the three that's different than the other two. If the rabbi said, "I want to be remembered as as somebody who went to Saturday services every day," there wouldn't be a joke. It would have to be something that's a surprise and something different. So often the linear, here's another example. At the show the other night, somebody asked the Swami some question about sexuality. And the Swami says, "Well, you're asking me about sexuality. I was celibate for 14 years." But when I turned 15, I said, enough of that. So there you have it. In other words, you set up a premise and then you pull the rug out by offering something that's a complete surprise and something different. Now, the way this relates to your original question, which is how is it used to create a different perspective, is that it bumps us out of our usual ways of thinking and offers a possibility for new possibilities of creativity in a way that hadn't been thought of prior.
And were you always funny? Were you somebody that came out with a great sense of humor and were just tuned in to the irony and the all those ingredients that natural born comedians offer us?
Well, I guess yes. In fact, as the story goes, when I came out, my first words were, "A funny thing happened to me on the way to the cervix." So,
bless your mind.
I was very fortunate to grow up in a family where humor was used. My dad was very funny. He was a great storyteller. He wasn't a professional comedian. But what I noticed was that he used humor in a way that didn't hurt anybody. He was not hurtful. And so I somehow picked up the cue. I think from my mother's side of the family, I picked up this spark for wordplay. My aunt, who is now going to be 94, she's still sending me funny names to put in my column, you know. So I think I had it like that. And in school, I was indeed the class comedian. And apparently the way you know that that's your archetype, the signal, the sign from God that you're chosen for that, is the first time you're in a lunchroom and you make somebody laugh so hard that milk comes out of their nose. And that's a sign from God, you're chosen, you know.
Very good. Very good. Well, if any of the listeners would like to ask a question to the Swami, you are all invited to call in and to the toll-free numbers. They are on the bbsradio.com website, and I'll offer you the toll-free one. It's 888-815-9756. If you have a question for the Swami, please check in. I really appreciate the state of the universe. And I wonder how you, if this is just normal, and when you go about your life, you are teasing and things like that. But you also I do notice in your writing, there is an undercurrent of a steady tease to love ourselves, which I really appreciate a lot. It seems to me consistent in your writing that there's always a gentle reminder that we could see a little different and be a little better and just have a lot more fun with this whole thing. And I want to acknowledge that I appreciate that in your writing and in the way that you do things. And can you tell us a little bit about, it's in your promo says 25 years you've been doing this. Did you just come out on the stage and do this, or were you just kind of led to it by the gift of your message and these sorts of things? How did you find yourself in the Swami hat?
Well, it was a long, strange trip. And, you know, I was class comedian. I obviously had humor when I was a kid. I made up song parodies, some of which I can't sing for you. And I was told, like everybody else, when you get to a certain age, adolescence and so on, that it's time to get serious. And so I tried. I really tried to get serious. I went to college. I tried to kind of blend in. But, you know, sometimes the universe has a different idea. And at one point, I was in a very boring lecture hall. It was a sociology class. And with 250 other very bored people. And I'm in this state somewhere between sleep and deep sleep. And out of the corner of my ear, I hear the professor, she was talking about social mores, And she said, and who can define for us social mores? And without even thinking, I stood up, and in kind of like a comedic Tourette's, what came out was, when the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. Yeah, like that. And of course, everybody laughed, but the professor was not amused, and she gave me a D. So, anyway, so I went on to a career. I was teaching, and a funny thing happened. And, you know, often we experience the universe's sense of humor with a funny thing happened. And mm-hmm. I was teaching at Wayne State University, teaching auto workers, and I loved the job. And I got laid off because they had to place their full-time people. And so the only job I could take was for the city of Ann Arbor, Michigan, as a tree trimmer. And so I was taking down trees that had Dutch elm disease. My mother, my Jewish mother in New York, to show you how nature-oriented we were in New York, I could tell she was concerned about something. She was afraid that I would catch Dutch elm disease. I said, well, you know, people don't get Dutch elm disease, but dogs get it. She goes, dogs get it. She was worried about Dutch elm disease. She says, well, what happens to dogs? I said, they lose their bark. But anyway, I continued with this job, and it really was a dark night of the soul. But then a funny thing happened. They put me with this new guy who was a brilliant psychologist disguised as a truck driver, and he came up with an idea. He said, you know, you're a writer. Why don't we start a little newspaper? And so we started an anonymous, humorous newspaper for the workers at the shop. And this transformed the workplace. It transformed my life because I recognized that I could influence people with humor. I could change energy with humor. I could speak about things that you couldn't speak about otherwise. I could get new ideas in under the radar. I can create playfulness and so on. And from that, I began to recognize this new gift. We started this little publication. And after 2 years, we had a few hundred subscribers all over the world who were tuning into the little happenings at the shop. And then about a year later, I started a paper in Ann Arbor called Pathways, which was one of the first holistic publications that dealt with spirituality and personal growth and holistic health and so on. And we knew, because as you were saying earlier, that when you first began this spiritual path, you were serious. And so we knew that people tended to take these things very seriously. And so on that basis, we decided that we had to have humor in the paper. And this name Swami Beyondananda flew into my head. And I say that I was struck by enlightening during a brainstorm. And the Swami became our mascot for Pathways magazine. And every month, he would have an article. We did one on teach your dog to heal, because dogs are natural healers. We did one on tantrum yoga, use your anger to heat your home in the wintertime. When people were getting involved with various religious and spiritual sects, we did everything you always wanted to know about sects, you know. So, and at some point, the call came to get out on the road and perform as the Swami. And so what you're hearing right now, you're hearing me talking to Steve, but if people do call in with questions, if you have an answerable question, the Swami will have a questionable answer, and you will be able to hear Swami Beyondananda for yourself.
Very good. So it literally is a role you step into, literally a birthing process is what you just shared with us.
Yeah, it was a combination of my natural affinity for humor, but the Swami character really gave the humor a much different feel. We came up with the term fool realization, to when you realize your own foolishness and you're able to laugh lovingly at yourself. And that is a very, very powerful place to be. It's a space of humility. Mm. It's a space of perspective. That was a word that you used right away. Perspective. And when you're able to laugh at yourself, when you're able to look at your own shadow parts without either running away or engaging in denial, but simply jokingly playing with that. And, you know, years ago, I was involved in a very contentious negotiation, and it just got worse and worse and worse. I'm doing this thing over the phone, and it was terrible, and almost every word that got spoken dug the hole deeper, and I hung up the phone and going, how do I fix this? And then I got an idea, and I called the other person up, and I said, hi, this is Steve Bierman. Did someone just call you pretending to be me? That person laughed, and we were able to, that kind of cleared the energy, because I was not attacking them. I was reflecting on my own plug-in and buy-in to this conversation and how I got whacked out. So if the key to humor is permission, and the best way to get permission is to create humor about yourself. We call it self-facing humor, where you're able to face your issues. It doesn't mean that you're insulting yourself. It's not, you're not putting yourself down. You're not doing something that's going to make other people turn away because you've obviously so deeply insulted yourself that it's embarrassing for them too. But if you could draw attention to something when it is your responsibility, then that opens the door and creates a sense of connection as opposed to separation.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think humility is the key. And when we get so focused on taking ourselves seriously, and especially when we're right about something and we're really grinding into how right we are.
Oh, yes.
You know, at that moment, we've completely lost perspective of the fact that we're in a big universe and that there are a lot of options to see and feel and think, and everybody has their own thoughts and feelings, and when we have to be right, that's often when I find the trouble starts.
Well, you know, Swami actually invented a word to describe somebody who sacrifices being happy for being right. It's called smarterdom. They're going to, you know, they essentially go, I'm smarter than you, but look at what they're giving up. They're giving up the connection, right?
Exactly, and the opportunity to grow more and to learn more and to expand from their perspective, their current database, basically. And that's, I was feeling that too, very much, that this whole idea of being right and the age of the expert is the old world. You know, we don't need the expert. We need all of our opinions. We need all of our thoughts, all of our feelings, all of our insights. And I've always been very inspired by certain aspects of Indigenous culture. And one of them is that in council, especially when the group is meeting with a very big question, one that affects all of the members of the tribe, everybody is invited to speak, and the children go first. The young ones, the ones that are tuned to the heart, you know, that have, you know, they're totally hooked up to their insight, to their intuition. Their opinion is very, very important. And that's the world that I see we're birthing, is that openness to truly cooperate, to truly share our insight and our understanding of things, because everybody does bring a little piece. And some people will bring more on some part, but none of us all know it all by ourselves. That's why we're in this together. And so when we all work together and find a way, we really do have a lot to learn. And the humility is really the key, because I think that we've been sort of tricked, our culture.
Yes, we've been tricked, yes.
Yeah, it's a funny joke, but it's not that funny. And it's funny and it's not that funny. I mean, it can be funny on the days when we can laugh at ourselves, because to think that we actually fell for this, that we actually fell for the idea that we were any less than eternal co-creators of the universe. I mean, When we really get to remembering who we are, this will be kind of funny that we actually bought this, you know, that we actually needed something to worship to feel important. I mean, that's, I mean, it is kind of funny. It's absurd. And at the same time, you know, it's where we're at, you know, it's the train we're on. So we're going to have to stay on the train and keep moving with it, you know, and, make the best of it. My mother and I shared a tremendous amount of hard times, especially in our early years. I mean, bizarre, very challenging times. And we just developed a way to find something funny in everything. Much like what you were saying about the Holocaust survivors. I mean, we just made it a point to laugh about things, and that really helped us in her last days too. I mean, farts were funny. Why not? You know,
air is human. Why?
Yeah. To find that place where, I guess, you know, it also makes you feel like you can do something if you can. You can laugh at it and move it around a little. It doesn't feel like, I mean, it's still there, but it doesn't feel like it needs to have the importance or the rigid focus that we give it. And
you know, I want to actually reflect a little bit on something that you offered just a few minutes ago, in terms of the council, in terms of using everybody's perspective. One of the projects that's very close to my heart right now that one might consider a little bit more serious, although the Swami is in this too, is my ebook with Joseph McCormick called Reuniting America, and you can find out more at reunitingamerica.org. And in this ebook, we talk about ways that people can bring together the very opposing and very sometimes contentious political sides into a breakthrough conversation, and council is exactly how it's done. In apparently the Native American councils, what they say is we speak and speak and speak until there's nothing left but the obvious truth. And in this circle, in this sacred circle, we are essentially everybody's equal, because in a circle, everybody is the same distance from the center. Nobody is more important than another in a circle. So in that equality, every individual, as you said earlier, brings a piece of the piece. And in holding that space, they become an antenna for really whatever the highest thought is on whatever that subject is.
That's really fascinating. And would you please tell us more about that book and your term transpartisan? This is really timely as a situation that we're going to laugh at one day in Wisconsin. I mean, wow. The guy rewrites the laws and then stamps it. And okay, so we can see there's some room for improvement here in our system. It's broken. And what I really like about this work is that you're not saying it's over, it's just broken, so let's fix it. And would you tell us more about that project and some of the other things that we would glean from this ebook and transpartisanship? Define for us that term. How do we become, you know, Republican tolerant if we are Democrat dug in?
Well, I like to use the word transpartisan because it means it crosses party lines. It doesn't deny that people have different opinions. However, I say it's transpartisan because it expands us beyond the partisan trance. Now, when we tend to be in this country, we've been divided and we've been divided, and I believe almost conquered by the divide and conquer mentality of the ruling class. We've been divided into two tribes, the red tribe and the blue tribe, and these are based on cultural differences as well as political. And so people tend to hang with and believe people in their own tribes. And so what happens is that we, under those circumstances, we cannot gather around the virtues and values that 90% of us share in common. So what we call the sociopathogens in the body politics tend to run rampant because we can't be united enough to stand against them. So I've been interested in politics for years. My background is in political science. And about 3 years ago, I met Joseph McCormick. And Joseph is a very interesting individual. His background is conservative, Christian, very Catholic, military, Christian coalition, Army. He's an Army Ranger. Ran for Congress as a Republican about 12, 13 years ago. Lost the election and went through a dark night of the soul and came out the other side with a much deeper understanding of transcendent politics. He studied the Founding Fathers. He interviewed well-known people on all sides. Then he ended up creating these retreats where he brought together the leaders of opposing organizations, MoveOn.org and the Christian Coalition. Al Gore and the chief Republican opponent of climate change legislation. And he created breakthroughs by creating sacred space, with the help of other people who are well-known negotiators. And William Urey, who wrote Getting to Yes, which is a key book in negotiating. And so after experiencing some success in that, Joseph decided that the next step was to bring together groups of ordinary citizens. And so he's been doing that for a few years now. And if you go to reunitingamerica.org, and if you get the ebook, you see that what ordinary citizens have come up with in terms of what we all agree on, it is absolutely awesome. When people are allowed to release temporarily their preconceived beliefs based on what they've been told and begin to, in a safe space in the sacred circle, begin to discover higher truths and bigger truths and more complete truths for themselves, that's when breakthrough takes place. And that's exactly what has happened in the group that he's been running in Seattle, Washington. People from really all across the political spectrum have come together in council, and new alliances have been created to actually, rather than spending energy fighting what we don't want, beginning to build in the local community more of what we do want. And we call this, as opposed to the fear-based homeland security, we call this heartland security.
So the council, is that the word that, is that how it's called in the book too? The council of, is that what the council of 12 is?
Well, we actually have, after really moving way past his background in fundamentalist Christianity and Catholicism, moving way beyond that, he began to study some of the deeper esoteric teachings. And he has found that 12 is a sacred number. And that something about 12 individuals in a group, you have enough people in there to have a certain degree of diversity. And then number 13, the 13th is the group as a whole. The 13th is the one that comprises the other 12. But fundamentally, the way that these groups are convened is you try to attract individuals that represent different polarities or different viewpoints. But in the context of the group, everybody is speaking for themselves. They're not there as a representative for their class or their race or their economic group or their political designation. They're there as an individual. And so as individuals, the first thing that happens in these groups is the heart space is accessed. There is a ecumenical prayer of intention that's neither religious or non-religious, but essentially establishes a group intention and a sense of coherence. And so if you have the intention that we are going to come to a common ground solution, if that's the intention, then everything else that's happening moves the conversation along the lines of that intention.
Well, that's very powerful. I mean, that's the lesson the universe offers us. I mean, that's key in co-creating is to set the intention, period. That's rule one. And I'm curious too, how do you address do you visit the conversation of what is commonly coined the shadow government? I am of the observation that it's pretty clear that the Federal Reserve Bank and certain entities that represent a global elite of another interest, which has nothing to do with America or American politics or any parties at all. Do you visit that at all in this book, or is it saying straight, you know, white bread politics, or is there any nuance of other possibilities happening?
That's a great question. And it really expresses or brings up the distinction between bipartisan and transpartisan. Bipartisan is essentially the centrist corporate state ruling elite from both parties joining forces at the middle to essentially narrow the conversation to make sure that nobody addresses these other darker pieces. What happens when people get together in an informal setting, meaning that it's not convened by a government organization, but it's convened by citizens bringing together a variety of citizens in their own community, then nothing is off the table. And as a matter of fact, I'll give you an example. I went to the first transpartisan summit was held 2 years ago, Lincoln's 200, the bicentennial of Lincoln's birth in February of 2009 in Denver. And we had what we called instant keypad voting, which is everybody gets a little keypad. It's electronic. And anonymously, you can, when there's a question, you can answer the question yes or no or whatever by hitting your keypad or A, B, C, or D. And so we had about 200 people there from literally across the political spectrum, from mainstream Democrats and Republicans to Greens, progressives, libertarians, militia, right-wing militia folks, socialists, everybody was there. And what was so interesting is that in the anonymity of the keypad voting, 70% of the people in that room thought that the 9/11 Twin Towers attacks was either allowed by the government to happen or an actual government operation. 70%.
Wow.
But because mainstream media does not allow that conversation to take place, or they manage it in such a way that you're led to a very specific conclusion.
Mm.
The power of these transpartisan groups is to address all of those things, whether it's chemtrails or some of the even darker depopulation things. And what happens is, you know, people begin to compare notes from the various sources that they're getting, and it's a process. It's an education process of how to educate yourself. And so instead of relying on the media, instead of relying on prepackaged information that's designed to divert us away from the truth, when people get together in a safe, sacred, heart-based setting, it becomes more possible to address these issues without people going into fear and denial.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes perfect sense. And that's actually quite lovely. I'm really happy to hear that you're doing that, and that, you know, I'm always surprised at the stories that come to me about things like this. And a lot of it has to do with, I think, just being open to that possibility, because if you do just watch TV and you do just, you know, allow the mind control to manipulate you, and you buy your products and you keep your denial in check, then fear is really the only thing you know. But when we're hearing these things of people actually having an opportunity to come together and to change the focus and focus, period. Focus and think. And when you are talking about these transpartisan things, are you doing that now? Is that part of your movement? Are you and Joseph organizing these transpartisan?
Joseph is organizing these, and I am participating. That's his main area of endeavor, is organizing those. And I am also communicating about it, traveling around and doing performances and presentations. Both about that. You see, I think that this there's several conversations that are really the same conversation. And again, all of these political issues, the political, the psychological, the spiritual, the economic, and the personal, they're really all the same thing. And in order for the political issues to be addressed, we need to address the personal, spiritual, psychological issues. So one of the programs that I'm doing right now is called Wake Up Laughing, Wise Up Loving, which is about using the power of humor to look at one's own shadow and then use that as a transformational tool to clarify communications with other people, to tell the truth to yourself about yourself, and do it in the context of universal love. And then from that space, you become a person that's a true resource for other people. You know, we've had you know, generations of leaders who don't walk the talk.
Mm.
And because of everything rapidly evolving right now and the old order falling away, what is required is absolute congruence and absolute integrity. And when that integrity is not present, we get signals that we don't like. You know, some of them could be health, some of them could be economic, some of them can be relationship. And these signals are, you're out of phase with this new organism being born. In the book that Bruce Lipton and I wrote, Spontaneous Evolution, Our Positive Future and a Way to Get There from Here, in that book, Bruce and I talk about a perfect biological metaphor for where we are right now is the transformation of the caterpillar to the butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the caterpillar is a very successful organism, but when it begins to change, there's great chaos. Everything begins to fall apart. And we're seeing that in our so-called Western civilization. The institutions are falling apart. The banks are robbing people. The healthcare system is unhealthy and uncaring. The educational system makes people less creative and more stupid, and on and on and on. So institutions are falling apart, but there's something falling together at the same time. Mm. In the caterpillar, in the soup that's created in the cocoon, these new cells called imaginal cells begin to pop up. And these are the first cells of a new butterfly organism. And at first they're isolated and they kind of fall away, but at some point they connect with one another. They form a community, and at some point there's enough of a threshold so that they can become the butterfly organism. So we are in that state right now, and our choice on a day-to-day basis, do we feed the caterpillar or the butterfly? Do we try to fix something that's not fixable, or do we build something that wants to be built in its place?
I totally agree and see the same thing, and it really is a very personal journey when it boils down, that we choose where we're going to invest our energy. We choose the company we keep. We choose the way we nourish ourselves, from the food we eat to the media we seek. And we are the ones that are, you know, at peace with ourselves, or we're the ones that are threatened by people who aren't like us. That's really all up to us. And because we're all eternal beings, the butterfly is the only place to go anyway.
Right. We're moving into that. Now, what's so interesting about the caterpillar, the butterfly, is that biologically they're the same organism. They have the exact same DNA.
Really?
Yes, they do. The difference is in the signal that they are receiving. So, and this is all in spontaneous evolution, which I urge people to, if you go to my website, wakeuplaughing.com, you can order that book and get a number of bonuses in addition. But this book combines biology, politics, spirituality, and economics into one conversation. It's really a follow-up to my co-author Bruce Lipton's first book, which is called The Biology of Belief, which talks about how our beliefs and perceptions influence our biology and hence our lives. And so in this butterfly, a caterpillar to butterfly, in our human society, in the butterfly, there's a different signal that the butterfly is receiving that brings it to a different level of coherence. In our human world, there is a different signal that more and more and more people every day are tuning in with, and that's the signal of connection. It's the signal that you mentioned earlier, that we're all in it together. It's mm-hmm. the signal that we're all cells in the same body of humanity, and it's that signal of love.
The unity consciousness and you must be familiar with the galactic alignment and these cosmic forces that are very much on our side with the DNA activation transformation that I feel are key. They're also very helpful. Some people will always have that state of preference in their being, and others will come into it. You know, I don't know the magic of the equation there, but I really do feel that right now so much is supporting that we do see each other as ourselves, you know, that what happens to you really does matter to me. It happens to me too. And that's a really beautiful place to be and to co-create from. And we are moving down the clock here. Will you tell us, you have one more book that you wrote yourself, and please tell us about that and any announcements or other things you would like to share with the listeners in the last few minutes that we have here.
Well, let's see. There's a couple of the Swami, who we haven't really met yet. I'll have to bring him in and have him talk to you toward the very, very end. The Swami wrote a book called Swami for Precedent, A Seven-Step Plan to Heal the Body Politic and Cure Erectile Dysfunction. And the reason why we're able to laugh at politics is because there's something funny going on. I have two ebooks that you can get. One is called Wake Up Laughing, An Insider's Guide to the Cosmic Comedy. And that really is an instructional on how to use the power of laughter to transform your life. The other ebook is called The Zen Koans, C-O-H-E-N, The Zen Koans of Hari Kohen Baba, and these are 36 of the most hilarious and profound, funny teaching stories. In other words, not only do they have a punchline, they have a point. And so if you're a public speaker or if you simply want to bring more humor into your life and understand humor better and appreciate it, the Zen Koans book is a very powerful way to do that. And those are both at wakeuplaughing.com. And the ebook, the Reuniting America ebook, is at reunitingamerica.org. And I believe you've got some of my links up on your blog. I have a Notes from the Trail blog. I think you've linked to a couple of articles. Upcoming on Monday, which is 2 days from now, I will be in Berkeley, California, as a part of the 25th anniversary celebration of Tikkun magazine, T-I-K-K-U-N. There'll be some very well-known luminaries there, and the Swami will offer a non-dominational invocation. Coming up on tour, we are looks like we are going to be in the Midwest and the East Coast, and we're booking events for May and June, Midwest and East Coast. In April, we have some events scheduled for the Bay Area. If you go to my website, wakeuplaughing.com, and the calendar, we're going to be updating it this week, so you'll see some new events on there.
Great. That's great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Yeah, really appreciate you taking the time. And so maybe this is an answerable question for the Swami Beyond Ananda. Tell us, Swami, in these days that we are facing, as our discovery of our greatness is evolving, is there one thing that we can do or shouldn't do, or is there one easy thing that we can do to feel better or to be happy when it's sad, and to shake this fear? How do we get rid of fear? How can we be present? How can we enjoy life when it's really rocking and rolling? I mean, quite literally.
Well, okay. I'm glad you asked that question. And I have good news for you. Love is more powerful than fear. Mm. Otherwise, we'd be singing "All You Need Is Fear." She fears you. Yeah. See, we're not singing. So that is a very positive thing right there. And the next thing to remember is wake up laughing and wise up loving. Love is very powerful. I have a new non-religion called fundamentalism with the accent on the fun. And we believe that life is a joke, but the Creator is laughing with us, not at us. And, you know, the fundamentalists, they believe that heaven is above us, but we fundamentalists believe heaven is where we make it. So why don't we go for heaven on earth just for the hell of it?
That's great. And that is from the Humanist Human Manifesto, correct?
Yes, the Fundamentalist Human Manifesto, or the Fun Human. And the other thing that's very important to remember, and this is our practice, we are not here on the planet to earn God's love. We're here to spend it.
Mm. Yes, indeed. Oh, would you please finish the Fundamentalist Human Manifesto? Would you please finish that for us? It is such a divine message.
Well, I don't know if I have it in my head. I can say that. I boil it down to this, that our purpose in life is to regrow the garden and have a heaven of a time doing it. And each of us individually, our mission is to allow ourselves to fully be filled with light and to let our light shine. The enlightened ones call that fulfillment.
Very nice. Very nice. And well, the last one, I'll read this because it's just, I really like this one. Non-judgment day is at hand.
Yes. That is when a non-judgment day. That is when everybody wins beauty contests and everybody lays down their arms. Now imagine, I'm talking about this, my vision of non-judgment day. All the nations at the United Nations begin their sessions with the hokey pokey. Look, the Israelis and the Palestinians, they put their whole selves in. They pull their whole selves out, that is detachment. They turn themselves around, that is transformation, and that's what it's all about.
Oh, I love that vision. Yes, indeed. Oh, thank you. Oh, bless your heart. Thank you so much for your time and for your bright spirit. And we are doing just great. Thank you for spending this hour with us. And thank you all to the listeners for joining us. And we will return in a fortnight. And my guest will be Anthony Kane. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jamil Graham, your host of Alchemy of Light.